And welcome back. This is Microsoft Virtual Academy. I'm Jerry, and this is Darren, and this is session number 11. 12. This is session number 12. I know, it just goes by so quickly. We're talking about building universal apps with XAML and C Sharp. We've talked about a lot.
We have talked about a lot. And that's why there is pause, rewind, and play.
Yeah, somebody was like, hey, you're talking really fast. Did nobody hear that we're paid by the word? Part two, this is a video, you can hit pause. Don't forget, the recording will be available in a handful of weeks, so just be cool. We have a lot of source code that we're showing you. We're gonna make all that available at xaml.codeplex.com, but not today, it'll be there in a few days. When we get it up there, we gotta scrub out all of our keys and stuff. That's the biggest change we need to make, to be honest.
Yeah, don't bother trying to get the keys out of the screen freezes or whatever on the videos, because we'll be disabling all of those accounts.
So except nice for try, one everybody. Of them. Except for one of them.
Yeah, and that one has the Lotus Elan.
The what?
Doesn't matter, carry on.
It's a car.
Ah.
Jerry doesn't know, he only knows about Prius.
Don't do that to me. Do not do that. Nothing's wrong with Priuses, by the way. Yes. Nothing at all.
Oh, God, I lost his door, Captain!
Woo! Okay. You yell that a lot in the back of a Prius. Feet down, go, go, go! At the final session, that's the one right after this, we'll have an open Q&A as well. We'll go through a lot of cool features that we know we didn't get to, but we were thinking we might. There was only so much time in the world, and you might actually get to them. It's pretty exciting to have that conversation. We'll do some architectural discussions as well. Mm-hmm. In this one, we'll talk about some advanced features, really some straightforward features that are probably going to be basic parts of any app that you build. I would imagine all of the features that we're about to show could show up in your application. If they don't show up in your application, I would be interested to know why, because these are core features that we've made extremely easy to implement based on all the guidance you're about to see. All right, so let's start by talking about resource loader, and then we're going to go into special behaviors. And so we're talking specifically about blend behaviors and a handful that we've created in order to solve some common problems, and you can sort of go from there. So we'll begin with resource loader. The resource loader service is a portion of the Prism framework. So as soon as you start using the Prism framework, you get it for free. And the resource loader is one of those things that has an interface. It's interface driven, so you can inject that into your service or into your services or view models as you want, right?
Yep.
Yeah, it makes sense to me. It's worth pointing out that the multilingual toolkit exists. This is a free...
Maybe we should take a step back and say what we mean by resources.
Let's do take a step back and talk about what we mean by resources. All right, sure, absolutely.
So, resources can be many things, but what we're really talking about specifically is those assets that enable you to vary strings mm-hmm. and other content based upon the language and locale that you're executing in. And so there's a whole resource framework that allows you to encapsulate string values behind these key identifiers that allow you to bring this information in and out of your application to display messages and so on. Jerry was talking about beforehand when we were talking about settings and the settings contract, where we had a number of UI commands that set up settings, about, and privacy. And you mentioned that those strings were great candidates for pulling out as resources. So what we meant by that is we could have some generic identifier that said settings token, privacy token or whatever, and that would be the key into this resource index that brings back these string values.
The way that we did this in .NET was we would use the resx file. Mm-hmm. That was a binary file that had a... probably use T4, but anyway, some sort of code generation piece around it that would turn it into a strongly typed class for us.
Yes.
We don't have that in the runtime. Instead, we have the ResW. And you might be thinking, man, I wish they would talk more about these resource files and all of these things like that. The good news is, we did.
Yep.
We talked about all of this in our previous MVA, all about using localization inside your application.
Mm-hmm. Localization and globalization.
Is that the advanced one or the basic? It's got
to
be advanced.
No, you'll have to watch all of them.
You'll have to watch all of them. They're right here on Microsoft Virtual Academy, and they're free. And they're awesome. They're awesome. All three of them are awesome. The C-sharp and the beginner. Not beginner. Basic. I don't even remember.
Essentials.
Essentials and advanced. Yep. All three are really terrific. But one of the things we spoke about, go ahead.
The other thing I wanted to say is, and we don't mean the same resources as that are in a XAML resource dictionary. They are a different type of resource.
You're right, because the XAML resource dictionary is more like a CSS file where we put styles and templates.
Yep, so I just wanted to clear those things up.
Well cleared, super clean.
Good job, my work here is done.
All right. Let's talk about the multilingual toolkit. This is one of the things that I talked about when we were talking about localization and globalization inside our previous MVA. But let me just say that this has been upgraded for Visual Studio 2003 Upgrade 3. If you happen to have it for Update 2, you need to upgrade it. Right,
because there's some interesting behaviors.
Yeah.
Like unable to rename your files.
Yeah, that's the one I had. It was killing me.
Yeah.
Anyway, it's a free piece. It's made by the Bing Translation team. And is that what they call themselves?
I have no idea.
I think it's the Bing Translation team. If not, you know what I mean. And anyway, what it does is it takes a resource file you've already created and then translates that into multiple languages, as well as creates a format that you can pass off to professional translators. We are not going to talk about the multilingual toolkit right now.
Nope.
We are only going to be talking about just resources and how to use them and how they're enabled by the resource loader that comes ships in the Prism framework. And the reason we're using that resource loader instead of the resource loader that comes in the framework itself is because this one is fully testable and interface driven. So there we are.
Yep. Good job.
All right. So I should probably demo the resource loader, but let's do it this way. I'm going to show how we use it inside Solarizer.
That sounds like a good plan.
Yep. Not every string inside Solarizer has gone through and been localized. That is to say, we don't draw it out of a resource file, mm-hmm. Which is completely contrary to the actual recommendation we would give to any developer, right?
Yeah. Well, certainly if you are intending to make your application available for use in any marketplace outside of the United States or an English-speaking country or whatever your native language is, that if you're going to deploy your application and make it available in the store outside of that marketplace, then obviously we would strongly recommend using the resources. If you know you're actually only going to release it to a very limited audience and so on and so forth, you could make the argument and it will probably be valid. It's not worth the additional investment in it.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, if you're creating an application that's a training application for your company, all three of your employees are right here working out of your house, then multilingual toolkit may be overkill. Well done. All right, so let me just pull up Visual Studio and show you. I've got, I happen to have our application ready. Look at this, I'm right here inside the map service. I was following along while you were talking. It's just so fascinating we were talking about that. All right, fascinating. Did I mention how fascinating it was? Okay, so let's think about this. The first place to consider, right, would be in the hub. So let me go up into Windows and show you inside our views folder is where we're gonna put all of our views, including our main page. I'll open up main page and show you the hub header. So the hub itself is right here, and it's not localized. Well, that is the weirdest. What? Let's talk about where the resource file is. That will drive me to what has been localized.
I know you've got the error dialogues in the app XAML are localized.
I do, but I want to show how to do it in XAML before I get to that, because we're going to be able to use these resources in two different places. One will be automatically handled by the framework. One will be manually handled by the developer. So let me go into I'll show you, this is where we put resources, and there's a convention that you use, and you use it on purpose, and that is to put it in a subfolder en-us. This indicates that it's US English. And so as it's looking for localized strings, it'll look into these subfolders. It's a convention to put it into the strings folder. This could be sitting right on the root if that's what we wanted. But because strings are reused, it's really easy to put that into the shared project, just like that. So let me double-click the resource W so you see what that looks like. It is a list of strings, and they all have a unique key. And then it is a list of values, and all of those values are set and typed by you manually, right? So this is my ability to say, so you can see a couple things that are kind of coming. It allows us to have messages, for example, just for specific exceptions and things like that. Again, I get to pick what the key is. There is one thing to notice, and let me start by saying this. This is the apphub.header, so it's setting the header value of the apphub, but only if the apphub has an XUID name of apphub. Let me set that. I could tell that it wasn't. I must have deleted it in some fit of rage. So let me just set it up. XUID. This is XUID is a lot like
you're
XName.
You're using the resource loader in the view model to bind to properties, and you're setting them that way.
Even the header?
You've got content title. That's what you're setting.
Perfect. All right, so let's look at XUID. XUID is special. XUID is right from the XAML framework, and what it does is it allows it to be recognized as participating in the resources. And so it starts looking for any type of control that matches a name. And so XUID, what's the name I'm going to put here? In this case, I'll put apphub, but I could put apphub Jerry if I want to, right? This is me to create a name that is not unique necessarily on this page. I could reuse this ID over and over on the page if I wanted to. What this is meant to match up with is back into the resources file. So if I look at the resources file, here's apphub right here. If I was going to name this apphub Jerry, I would have to make sure I change this to apphub Jerry, but I'm not going to because we didn't rename it. And then it has a dot after it. I don't know if you can see that, but it's a dot representing that now I'm going into one of its properties. And in this case, I'm going into the header property. And I'll set its value just to a raw string called Solarizer. There are other things I could change. If I needed to change the apphub.height, apphub.width, apphub, you just fill it out from there. Whatever it is you need to, you can store those values right here, and you get a converter that automatically takes the string that you put into this resource file and makes it into the proper type that's you're indicating after the dot, basically. And so here I'm saying I want the header value to be Solarizer. Well, let's see what the value is right now for the header. Oh, that's why, because we took it, that's what happened. All right, perfect. If I add a header, the header is hidden is the reason.
Exactly.
Yes.
I think what you did was you built another demo for it.
I probably
that's
did.
What you remember.
So I'll say the header is test. That's me hard coding it right now. You can see it just below right there. What I like to do is just a convention is to put a tilde in front of it so I recognize that whatever text I do put in here is just for the sake of design, and it will be replaced at runtime by the resource loader automatically. Again, this part that I'm showing today, or right now, is not part of Prism. This is just built into the XAML UI framework.
And it's actually incredibly powerful.
It's incredibly powerful. That's exactly right. So I'm going to go ahead and run this on... I'll switch the project to Windows. Local machine is fine. I'll go ahead and run it. And what you'll see, it's not tilde test when I run it. What it is going to say Solarizer. The reason is at runtime, it finds that XUID. See, here's Solarizer. It finds that XUID, and then it matches it with the resource, looks for the resource file, looks for the property that matches. In this case, it was .header. I could have used .text if it was a text block or something like that as well.
So are you restricted to just using text values on those properties? The answer is no. You can specify width and height and so on and so forth also in those resources because, say for example, we had a title that was a functional name and it was translated to a different language. That title may or may not be a right. longer string, a shorter string, may take up more real estate and so on. So the power of this capability allows us to specify not only different content, but also sizing, font families, all manner of different elements that can be localized to ensure that when the translation occurs, the content will fit in the available space.
That's right. And so this is about declaration inside XAML. Using XUID. XUID, not only is it specific to XAML, but it's also something we as developers don't use, right? I'd really like to get all the ones with XUID. That's not exposed to us, at least right now. And so it's really just intended for this resource and localization insertion for us. All right, so that's the first way to do it. But that doesn't solve problems like the message dialog. When I'm popping up a message to the user, I pop up that message, send the title and content to it, or maybe even the buttons like close and retry. Those buttons then are all going to be in English if I hard code them. I don't want that to happen. And so, in fact, let me show you right here inside. I'm going to go back. No, I'm already in shared.
Location.
Beautiful. And so here I am inside AppXAML. And so all the way at the bottom is where we have the logic to handle unhandled exceptions, right? And so this is, here we are, app underscore unhandled exception is the name of our handler for that event whenever it's raised in our application. And a couple of things that we do allow us to, for example, right here, you see we use the web API exception, which Darren demonstrated in the last hour. That's very specific to web API. It's raised up. But then how are you going to respond to that? Oh, okay. We'll give some information to the user that makes a little bit of sense. So in that case, we'll look to see what the HTTP status code is that's included inside the exception. And if it's unauthorized, then we give a specific message to the user in a dialogue service show that shows specific content just for the unauthorized exception. We also then have other types of, in this case, it's going to be other types of status codes. Mm-hmm. But we just do default from here. But from this point forward, we might show something else. In this case, we recognize this is a terminal exception.
Or exceptio, apparently.
Exceptio in. And something, you know, bad has happened. We're not able to diagnose it. Or we just don't have, you know, the need or desire to do it as well. And so now we have the same content and title, but look what's actually being used here. The resource loader, this is provided to us from Prism. And the resource loader has a get string. Get string passes in an exact string that matches what might be in the resource file. So here's the resource file again. And I look for the terminal exception content. That's what we were looking at before. And you'll notice there's a dash right there. You might think, wow, you know, the way I would do it, I would put a dot right there. And as soon as you did, it just would stop working. The reason it would stop working is because now it's looking for an XUID element called terminal exception that has a property called content, which you're not going to find, right? So if you're going to do this where it's just an ad hoc string that you're going to be using for something like a dialogue message or a message dialogue, then use dash instead or don't use anything, whatever naming convention you want. Just don't put a dot in there.
Yep. If you do, you actually get a very strange error in your building.
That's right. It's a PRI.
Make PRI.
That's right.
And effectively what's happening behind the scenes is, as Jerry says, it's trying to generate code that is going to update a property on a control. It can't find it, can't satisfy it, but at the point where it's occurring in the build cycle, for whatever reason, it can't surface up a decent error.
Right.
And so you get these strange, funky errors. So it took a little bit of a while to track that down, didn't it?
The app stopped working for a long time.
Yes.
And you're like, Jerry, why are you using a resource loader all of a sudden?
And why if I roll back, does it work?
I've got a demo. All right, perfect. So you can see the content of the message that we're about to pop up is called, or it reads, you know, the application must exit. The exit command, so this is the button that we're going to give, is close application. Remember, this is a terminal exception. Something serious just went down. And then we also provide a title and just terminal failure as well. So now I can create another folder. That could be FR for French, and I could put a resource file in there depending on the settings of the user's user's window session. If they are in the locale of French, FRFR in this case, for French France, mm-hmm. French fries, then they can it'll automatically look in the FRFR folder instead of the ENUS. If it doesn't find that to satisfy the locale that they're in, it'll fall back to ENUS. That's what's nice. So if you miss a language, then you don't get a blank dialogue. But the more languages you cover, the larger your potential audience of users.
And also, it does understand cascades and defaults within a language context. So if you have a FRFR, and then you may have say, FRCA.
Yeah.
If you're running in Quebec, and the application hasn't actually installed an FRCA variant of French, then it will actually fall back to the primary definition of the French resources that it has. It's actually pretty clever that way.
Yeah, it's quite clever. A. That's, you have to put that in there. Oh my goodness. All right, anyway, so the resource loader again is interface built, so that means I can pass that in. In fact, let me show you where that is. I have a view model here that is specific in the main page view model. If you look at the constructor of the main page view model, remember we collapse it into a region because you just don't need to interact with this normally. It's just a way for me to indicate what resources I need so they'll be injected by Unity, but I'm gonna go ahead and expand it so we can kind of freak out. Anyway, here's where the resource loader is stored as a field. And then I ask for it right there, right? So we know Unity will inject that for us. And then I just take care of it, make sure it gets put in the field right here. So let me go ahead and collapse that down, knowing that underscore resource loader is now part of this view model. And I can kind of rely on that thanks to the Prism framework and to Unity taking care of that for us. So now when I have here's a great example. So here's an exception just occurred. And the error is, you know, whatever, it doesn't really matter, but I can follow the exact same pattern here instead of using the resource loader that's available in the AppXAML CS. I'm using the one that has been injected into this view model. I go and get the string from here. Now it might be, because you know, I don't really like literal strings. I just do not like literal strings. It might be that we figure all these out and then take the time to move them all into an enum. That's really up to you as the developer, or maybe you have the literal strings right here as well. I don't know the right solution for that. Right now this feels like it's good enough, but every time I see a quotation mark inside my C#, it makes me feel like something's not right. So that's kind of up to you, but nonetheless, because you can pass this around as a resource, or inject it as a resource, you can use this loader to go get the strings and make sure that you're localized properly no matter where you are inside your application. Pretty great. That's the resource loader. The resource loader isn't necessary when all you're using is that X UID inside XAML. It's all taken care of by the framework. But then you also have the resource loader if you need to go get this for all the things that aren't taken care of automatically by the framework. So that's the loader service.
Nice.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, for the next part, we'll be talking about behaviors. It's not about you, Darren.
It's not about me and my bad behaviors.
This is about special behaviors.
Uh-huh.
I didn't know what to call it. It seems weird to call it. I could have called it exotic behaviors. I didn't know what to do.
Yes. Moving right. Swiftly on.
Yeah. Well, actually, let's talk about what a behavior is real quick. If you are a developer, and if you're a XAML developer and you've ever used Blend, which I certainly hope you have. And if you're thinking to yourself, what is Blend? I always hear people talk about it. I sure wish there was a dedicated MVA just on how to use Blend. You're in luck.
That's funny.
There is one. Let's see.
It also has a dancing monkey.
It also has a monkey. That's right. Nonetheless, you can go get that right here at Microsoft Virtual Academy. I'm the
monkey.
Professor, the instructor on it, and it goes through every aspect of Blend you could possibly imagine. It's really excellent all the way through. So there's your opportunity to go learn everything around Blend. Back to what we were talking about. All right, if you're a XAML developer and you're thinking that you want to encapsulate and declare all the activity around your UI, you're in luck because you can use behaviors. The iBehavior interface, which was reintroduced, it was taken away for one version and brought back, not because we didn't want it, but because it wasn't complete. It was completed and put into place in Windows 8. Was it Windows 8.1 when we got it?
I think it was.
I think it was too. And now with iBehavior and iAction, you can write all of the pieces that you can be declared inside XAML and used when you're using Blend to build out your UI. So what that means is I can use C# code to write up some things that surface on the designer itself. And I can drag them around, declare them, have a UI to interact with them, and it's actually quite nice. Those are called behaviors. There's quite a few that come to us out of the box. In fact, there are quite a few that come to us, so many that come out of the box, and they're so configurable that it kind of erases the need for several of the ones that you might build on your own. But we need to build some, and so I have built a handful to kind of show how to deal with.
Do you have a few moments to show some of those in Blend?
I sure am just about, yes, indeed.
That's sounds like a good blind.
Dork. what was that? I was on a roll. I was really talking about something.
Yeah,
all right, let's talk about a couple of scenarios that we need to resolve and the way that we resolve them using behaviors and the way easily you could resolve them. It's too, also using behaviors. Again, behaviors can be used just by including them in your project, just like a C# file. Well, they are just a C# file. And as long as they're in scope of your project, they appear inside of Blend. So forward and back support is one of the important parts of accessibility. So in order to move around inside your application, Darren, it might be difficult if you have some sort of some sort of missing capability, right? I can't touch my screen for whatever reason, use the keyboard or whatever, and the way I want to navigate, need to navigate, is, let's say, using the forward and back on my mouse, right? This is a special key gesture that would come in and be used. Sometimes it's my only option, right? And your application doesn't support that. I'm kind of out of luck. There's a lot I can't do, and I don't want it to be like that.
We've spent a lot of time talking about the accessibility aspects of these things, and it is key, you know, especially if you want to have broad reach.
Especially if you want to have broad reach. There's also a reality that features like this, let's say navigation with your mouse, that's pretty nice for me. I actually don't have a problem clicking the back button if it's there. But the fact that I could use my mouse as well means that some of the work you put towards accessibility actually makes a better experience for everybody. It's really nice. All right, so let's take a look at what that is. I'll show the key navigation behavior and kind of how that works. Earlier we were talking about the key service, the keyboard service, and this is some of the logic brought into a behavior so you can see how that's used. So I'm going to open up our project here that we have. Did I make a change to AppSAML.cs? I won't save it, for Pete's sake. All right, so where do we put behaviors? All you have to put them in is in scope of your project. So for me, I put them in the shared project inside the behaviors folder. And I have two behaviors that I want to show you today, and the first one is this key nav behavior. What does the key nav behavior do? It listens for all the keystrokes that are occurring, determines if those keystrokes are the back navigation or the forward navigation, and if they are back or forward, then they proceed to navigate back and forward to obey that gesture. That's all that it is. If you want it to work, you add it to your page and configure it from there. So the first thing to notice, and let's see if I can do this.
Is it a bad idea adding these things in that are global listeners and being called all of the time whenever you touch a keyboard or anything along those lines?
I think the answer is no. And the reason I think it's no is because there are only so many options that we have.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think?
Well, I think obviously, if you were to put hundreds of different behaviors on here, all that were subscribing to the same events, then you could actually start creating quite a backlog of processing. So I think there's a particular style that you can adopt, which is to return from whatever behavior you're doing to very quickly identify whether you actually should be being invoked or whether it's something that you don't care about.
Yeah, that's absolutely right, actually. If it turns out that you feel and start recognizing as a developer, man, I'm listening to this event everywhere, maybe you do need to aggregate that up and maybe use a message or something like that that gets broadcast out rather than holding on to it in so many different places.
Yes.
Because it could be a lifetime problem as well.
Certainly, if you start attaching these behaviors within a data template, and that data template could be blown out across 1,000 items in a list.
Yeah. Yeah, you're right. All right, so if you're going to create a custom behavior, there is very little you have to really implement. All custom behaviors first inherit from the dependency object and then implement iBehavior. Let me jump into iBehavior so you can see what's required. It's not very much. One property called associated object and two methods. One is attach and one is detach. Attach is basically where you're going to wire up to an event if that's what this behavior is going to do. Detach is where you're going to unwire from an event if you happen to wire one up in attach. So let's look how we do that inside the keyboard navigation behavior.
Conceptually, they seem very similar to attach properties.
Conceptually, they're like attach properties, but they're so much better because the pain of attach properties is that everything is in a static context, which means you don't always have reference immediately to what's going on. You always have to say, what's being passed to me? I have to cast that back to whatever it is. And it's really, really painful. If you use a behavior, you have immediate, first of all, you have a way for it to start, which is an attached property doesn't have a way for it to start. If you have functionality built into your attached property, let's step back just for a second. There are four ways to customize any kind of control inside XAML. One of them is the behavior. Another one of them is a custom property. Another one is to inherit from a property and subclass it. And the fourth one I can't remember.
Well, that sounds good.
Wait, there really are four, and I can't remember the fourth. But let's go. Those are the core ones. Is the subclass it, so I would make it my grid view instead of the base grid view because I want it to do something. That's awesome, and it works fine, and usually has a really great place. But you can't drag things off of the toolbox and use them as if they're standard. Mm-hmm. You have to know how they're implemented. Sometimes that's harsh. The second one is what you just brought up, the attached property. Attached property is like a... It's exactly like a dependency property, only allows you to inject into the property bag of a control your own custom value, whatever that is. But it also has a changed event so that when any of those properties change, that changed event is where you can put your custom behavior or custom implementation, right? Yeah. I don't want to overload the word behavior. So the upside to that is it can go anywhere, and it's very usable. And most SAML developers understand how attached properties work because we use them for Grid, we use them for Canvas, and their attached properties just kind of flow. However, the downside is if that value never gets set, the behavior itself can't be implemented. So often, if you look at how, for example, our view inside our main view here uses the main view right here, uses the attached property given to us by Prism, right? This view model dot auto wire view model, right? Fantastic. And we set it to true. But why would you really set it to true? That doesn't make sense because you'd never set it to false. Mm-hmm. The reason you set it to true is because if you look under the hood, this is actually wired up to the changed event, because otherwise an attached property never executes.
Yep.
Because it never has an initialize, it never has a setup or anything. The only thing that you have is the changed event on that property. So it's a handy way to extend something. That's the reason it was done here. But it's actually a kind of a painful way, because from that point forward, it's out of context of the item that's attached to. You only are in a static kind of relationship with that, mm-hmm. and you always have to cast it back. So behaviors solve so many of these problems. Super lightweight, easy to implement, and you have all that. You have the attach and detach, which is basically that initializer and deinitializer destructor, I guess. And but you also have an immediate rep. That's what the associated object is, a non-static reference to the object that you're attached to. It's really a beautiful thing. And it is true that the associated object ends up being a dependency object and you're going to cast it, but that's not that big of a deal. I do the exact same thing, put it into the associated object, but also cast it into a local field so I can use it as well. All right, so what does that mean? It means as soon as I attach to two things. The first thing is the accelerator key activated. That means somebody pressed something on the keyboard. The second thing is the pointer press. That means somebody pressed something on their mouse. That's how I'm going to detect whether or not they're using the back button on their mouse. And this is how I detect whether or not they're using the back button on their keyboard. Then I have the handler for both of those down below. And we don't have to look at the code for that. There's no need to see that. I just want you to know that it's there. We're going to give this to you and you can look at it yourself. And then in the detach, this is the, look at the detach is built in correctly. It needs to be a minus equals instead of a plus equals. This is live debugging is what it is. It's almost like I might have, anyway, none of that matters.
Moving swiftly on.
But I'd like to demo this. So, by the way, that's a really good fix, that minus equals. But this is not a reference implementation. This is a demonstration of what can be done, right? So take a look at how that works. Anyway, this is the logic right here, but I have two properties set up. What that means is as soon as I add this behavior, I get to see that I get to set it and configure it whether or not I allow go back or allow go forward. I might set that to false and say I never want the user to go forward no matter what they do, because I want to control that programmatically every single time. Fine, you can turn that off and this is the way it goes. You need to add another property maybe so you can do something else? Great, only when it's on the phone, only when it's in portrait mode, whatever you want. You can control this all you want. This is just custom code for you to build as a custom behavior, but it does work the way that it is. Let me show appointment page inside Blend. So if you want to visually work with behaviors, you have to do it inside Blend. You cannot visually work with behaviors inside Visual Studio. So just kind of roll with that and go with it. There's an additional piece, by the way. Behaviors often are the thing that interact with events, and then it won't open the database projects, let's say. And then,
funny old thing.
And is this my first time using Blend? Why is it giving me all these these warnings that it
You should go and check that video from that guy that tells you how to use it.
Yeah, I should. He's a jerk. I can't stand watching him. Talks so freaking fast. It's amazing.
And so much.
And so much. It's like he's paid by the freaking word.
Yeah, and he's on the camera for some reason.
All right, no monkey, thank goodness, right? If you look at the Assets tab inside Blend and go down to Behaviors, everything that's in scope, including the ones that they ship with the framework, are here. So the one that is new to us here is this key nav behavior that I've already dragged onto the page. So you could see it's right here inside the objects tree. This is the logical tree of XAML inside your page. And if I go over to the properties window here, you can see it only has two properties, and it's the two that we created custom, the allow go back and the allow go forward. Something I'll point out about those properties that they aren't ordinary CLR properties. These are dependency properties. That allows me to data bind to them. It even allows me to animate them. Hopefully you don't animate them because that doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
But what that allows me to do is say in some situations I don't want to go back, in some situations I do. I'll bind to my view model. My view model can decide that problem, and we'll just communicate it up to our behavior like that. Now when it's here, if I were to run the application, I'm going to go ahead and run it. And kind of, I don't know how I'm going to demonstrate. I'm clicking the mouse, but I'll show you anyway. I didn't make any changes to it. And so it'll come up to the main page. I'll navigate, let's say, to this one. I want to go back. The way I go back is to click this little back button right here. It works fine. That's because I'm interacting with the UI itself. What if I wanted to use the keyboard or mouse? I'll use the back button on my mouse, and as soon as I click it, you'll just have to trust that's what I'm doing. It goes back like that. If I wanted, I can make it so it goes forward, and it goes forward to, let's say, the last
appointment you clicked.
Appointment that I opened up, right? That'd be really neat too. And so there's different things that I can do like that. And anyway, so this is a reusable behavior I could add to almost any project, immediately add this functionality to it. I'll just point out that you could have a page and not have forward and back navigation, but this would not be accessibility friendly. And it also just kind of adds some neat functionality that every user can benefit from. So that is the key navigation behavior. Simple enough, we've included it in Solarizer and we're going to give it to every developer. All right, the next thing is handling orientation. Handling orientation is application specific and it's also platform specific. In the early sessions that we did yesterday, we really talked about there is tons of variety around the different devices and the shape and the size of them, right? Mm-hmm. But the reality is the way that you deal with orientation is going to be based on your application. Sometimes when the user turns to be portrait, you don't want to make any changes at all. You're totally satisfied with that. So if I were to pull up like the MSN News app, right? Mm-hmm. And I were to switch that to be a portrait or to snap it to the right so it's only the right-hand side of the app, no change whatsoever. They're totally happy with it being the way it is when it's portrait. However, different apps work different ways. Sometimes you want to change the vertical scroll or you want to change the scrolling so it's vertical instead of horizontal. Fantastic. Do it that way. So it's going to be based on different applications. I would really like to figure out how to make this work. Great. I created a behavior to help with orientation decisions by using visual states, which is the easiest way to change the way your UI looks and is defined in XAML. So let's take a look. All right. This is the orientation behavior. Where is it right now? It's in the shared project, and it's right here. What it does is it allows you to indicate what visual states you have and when you want to use them. So I'll say it's hard-coded for now because it really only supports three states. It supports phone, it supports portrait, and it supports landscape. Do you need to extend that so that it does something special for your application? No problem. All the code's right here, and honestly, there's not much to it, right? You can totally do it. Look, I have this little property at the bottom, is phone true or false? I used a pound if to return true for phone, and a pound if to return false when not. Hey, it gets it done, and it's really nice.
Yep.
I wouldn't want to use a shared file. I mean, good golly. Can you imagine? All right, so let's go back to Blend. So here, let's see. Here we are in Blend, and I want to use the orientation behavior. We do use the orientation behavior already inside Solarizer. We don't use it on this page. We actually use it on the user control that we put on every page, that header. Mm-hmm. So let me show you. Under projects here, that's how I navigate to it. Under views, I'm going to go down to shared, open up views here, and there's the header right here. So this is what we put common on every one of them, right? There's a couple aspects to the header that's pretty nice. This is great, too. It really saved us a lot of repetitive code that really wasn't necessary. So on the left here, inside a spot that you can't see, is the ability to go back. This is bound to the header view model, which is part of all of our view models now. And
that has a reference to navigation service and is bound against can go back.
That's exactly right, 100% right. And so it hides itself automatically if it can't go back, shows itself if it can. That's really nice. And so we've made a little place for it. It's right there, and the logic is executing inside the designer, and it thinks it can't go back, which is true because I haven't gone anywhere. we should make it so it returns true if it's the designer, then we'd see it. I don't know why we didn't do that. It doesn't matter. Then we have a little section right here. It's the header. This will be important in just a second. And then on the right-hand side, after authentication, I see the first and last name of the user, and then a button that allows us to quickly go into settings. That's where we would log out or just something like that. I could add anything else I want there. Well, the reality is this is pretty nice, but if I were to shrink it a little bit, so let me shrink this down. I might make it so that, can't grab the edge. Why can't I grab the edge? There we go, perfect. And so this is probably the most narrow that I'd find. This is 500 wide. And you can see Solarizer, the logo now is clipped off. It doesn't look right. This is not the way we want it to look. What are we going to do now to make sure that this works properly and has a nice experience for all the users?
Show a dialog that says turn your device background so it's wider.
We could show a dialog that said portrait is not supported. You know, that is a reality.
Yeah.
We could actually do that to say. And there are games that do that. Right? Because they only support landscape. And so you turn in portrait, they're like, turn it back and we'll play.
But generally that would be a bad idea.
Generally it's a silly idea and it's a sign of a lazy developer, I don't mind saying. All right, so what do we do here? We create right up here in states, we create several view states, visual states. Each of the visual states allows us to define what we want it to look like. So let me go back and make this wide so we can see all the states in their glory. So the first is landscape. Hopefully you see there's no change at all. This is the way we want landscape to work. It's also the base way it looks as well. And so everything is visible if we want it to be. And I go now to portrait. Portrait is sort of our narrow, right? This is the 500 wide. What do we do then? A couple of things. We change it so that the logo is now really, really narrow because it's just this tiny little square. There, our main logo without the text. What that allows us to do is now if we see how it looks narrow, everything looks really nice. And because we've made this change, they can understand why there's been a change to the UI because we're making everything fit. And so there it is.
It works.
Pretty nice way of doing it. Your UI might even need to account for a more narrow way of doing it, right? Maybe you need to account for the 320 wide, where now you have to hide a couple other pieces in order to make it work.
Yeah, probably the name and you'd leave the name and the logo.
Yeah, that's exactly. Yeah, name and logo. The last thing you would
settings
create.
Settings and logo, I meant.
The last thing you would create is, say, the phone visual state. How do you want the phone visual state? We actually didn't implement the header into the phone yet, so we didn't build out the way that the header would look on phone. But I could go in here and say, okay, now when it's the phone, so forget about landscape, forget about portrait. I'm just going to handle phone from here. I want it to look like this, right? And so I go in and I build it out so it's specific for my mobile experience. And so now, back to the behavior. So now I have a behavior, and it's the orientation behavior right here, and I add that to the page. Well, I've already added it to the page. You can see it's been added right here and just has a couple of properties to it. So if I go over to the properties, I can see that the first thing it wants to know is what's the name of the visual state that is used for landscape? Well, there it is right there. What's the name of the phone visual state? Well, there it is right there. And it's nice, there's a decorator on the behaviors that I can use, the behavior properties that I can use that allow me to build out these drop-downs automatically. This one's built in already. And I can pick portrait state and kind of go from there. So it doesn't guess, it doesn't use a convention that you have to match just right. You just build it out yourself. And if you wanted that narrow state, which we kind of hinted at before, or if you wanted to handle phone to be landscape and portrait as well, you just add another property and update the logic so it matches the need of your application, right? This just gets you started down the line, and it works fine for us as well. In fact, let me demonstrate how this works inside Solarizer. So, here we are. Look at us right here in Solarizer. So right now, this is the landscape orientation. Hopefully you recognize that it's the full word and as well as the logo. And we have the name and the button over here on the right. This is the header being used right here. If I were to navigate into an item, it's the same header being used again. But here we are showing the back button as well. So let me change this to portrait. Easy enough, I'll just make it so that's half the screen. As soon as the width is less than the height, that's portrait. And so I'll drop it here, it'll become portrait. You can see that the orientation behavior executed for us, and it made a change from one visual state to the other for us. And so now I'm inside the portrait, or at least the narrow, let's say narrow, more narrow, visual state. It's changed it so there's no name here and everything fits nicely. I could even kind of tighten it up and make it a little bit smaller.
Unless you hit it.
Make it just a little bit smaller like that. And this is where you see it really pays off not to have the word Solarizer there. Right? It's pretty great. As it gets more and more narrow, I could raise yet another event, move to yet another view state. That's really visual state. That's really up to the developer in their application. So let me show you the base implementation. And again, we're just going to ship this with with Solarizer so you can see what's going on. Let's see. Bonk, right there. This is the orientation behavior. And so if you remember, there is a there's an attach and detach.
You want to get rid of your Server Explorer on the left there?
I'll get rid of both. How about that?
Yes, looks good.
So again, we have to both inherit from dependency object and implement iBehavior. When you implement iBehavior, you get the associated object, and you also get attach and detach. That's the only thing inside that interface. And so attach, you see, I go ahead and attach to size change, but I also attach to activated because that allows if it's being snapped around, or allows if it's being if it's that allows that if it is suspended and then resumed, I also get activated as well. Mm-hmm. So it allows me to quickly make that change, and then I get to call it initially because I want it to run right away, not just when the event occurs because it may never be resized, but I still want to be in the right visual state. All right, so I just want to point out that I have, just as before, a dependency property that I created, and one called landscape state name, one called portrait state name, and one called phone state name. All three have been decorated with the same attribute, the custom property value editor. This comes in the this comes with the Behavior SDK. Behavior SDK ships with Visual Studio, but it doesn't automatically get referenced inside your application until you do it manually or until you drag a behavior on for the first time inside a Blend. So you get it, you just have to add that reference. If I were to show you, it'd just be right here. Right there, right? That's behaviors suddenly start to work as soon as I make that reference point. And so these are the three, and because I indicate what it is that I need for that property value editor, I indicate that it's going to be a state name. It knows it needs to sniff all of the visual states that are going to be in scope and show as options. So that's why we had that drop down with all the visual states. Pretty cool, actually. There are a couple other options you could do if I were to hit dot there for you, but stop the application first. I'll stop it instead of pause it.
Sounds like a good plan.
If I were to hit dot there, you can see there's a couple other things, including element binding, which means I'm going to bind to one of the XAML objects on the page, and storyboards. This is great, so I need to reference a specific storyboard for this property or whatever it is I'm going to do. It also sniffs all of those out that are in scope. So pretty cool there. I'm going to take that dot, extra dot away. That's the full of it. But then if you look at the if you look at the activated, right, you see they don't actually do anything. They just call update orientation because all of that can be wrapped into a single method. Here's update orientation. It really is pretty simple. If it's the phone, then it goes ahead and shows the phone visual state. Otherwise, it shows the two depending on whether or not it is landscape or portrait. So I can do that from application view, get current view. It'll tell me the orientation and do the calculation for me. So it saves me about 1 second of typing. And anyway, so I go in there, raise landscape. If it's been set, I do have one little check. It's possible they haven't given me a visual state. I don't want to cause the application to, you know, error out. And so I just make sure first that the visual state's been set in this behavior. And if it has, then I switch to it.
Sounds awesome.
It's as easy as that. All right, so we talked about three quick things that really are valuable inside every application. These last two are about behaviors. They're an excellent way to encapsulate complex implementation. One of the realities is that interacting with code or some of these APIs is tricky. You may be more experienced than some of the other developers on your project, so you can encapsulate some of this code inside a behavior and just ask them to use the behavior and not to write the code themselves.
The other great thing about them is it actually facilitates advanced capability for somebody who may be more of a designer and is just building this using Blend as their development tool. They can quickly connect up certain behaviors that would really require a coder.
Boy, is that a great point. Here I am inside a Blend, dragging that behavior on, setting the visual state. I never even saw C#, and I get all the functionality.
Exactly.
Yeah, you're right. That is really, really fantastic. All right, developer tip, blank. It really was. All right, so we talked about the resource loader. This is basically for localization. We saw how you can do that with the XUID. That's built into the XAML framework. But we also showed how we can use it to extract strings that have custom keys so that we can put those into special things that aren't taken care of for you as the developer, right? Things like the message dialogue. Then we talked about the two special behaviors. First, the what was the first one? Key navigation.
Key navigation.
Right?
Can't forget key.
That does that and also gives a little bit more accessibility to your app. And then we talked about orientation behavior that kind of handles switching between different visual states that you've set up depending on the orientation of your application. All three, super important. All three, I think, should show up in almost every application. I'd be interested why it wouldn't, for sure. And that is the end of this module.
Okay. We have one more module to go.
At the end of next module is also a Q&A.
Yep.
Where we'll jump on the chat with all of you guys. We'll see what's going on. If you have a question, we'll answer your questions as best as we can as well. And that's it. Let's take a 10-minute break, come back, and wrap up to get the day here together.